Here's a change in corporate human resources. More companies are hiring chaplains. These are the same kinds of people with religious training you find in the military or on college campuses. Chaplains work in companies to help people talk through office frustrations. Here's Lauren Silverman of our member station KERA in Dallas.
Every week, Chaplain John Eaton knocks on the doors of employees at Purdy McGuire, an engineering firm in Dallas.
Hey, Scott. How's it going, man?
How's it going is more than a greeting. It's part of Eaton's job. He talks with employees about anything, sports, church, problems at home. Scott Brown is a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormon faith. He likes the check-ins.
A lot of times, you know, we're dealing with deadlines and stress and things like that, so it's nice to have somebody come in and just unload for a minute and get away from it.
Our job is a lot of it just to help them see that there's hope.
Eaton visits 30 companies every week. He works part-time for Marketplace Ministries, the nation's largest provider of workplace chaplains. The Plano-based nonprofit is huge. With an annual operating budget of $14 million, it sends thousands of chaplains into high-rises and factories across the world, from Pilgrim's Pride to BNSF Railway.
Some places, you know, they're more reserved, and it takes a long time to build credibility with the employees. I've had people brush me off for 3 years, and 3 years and a day goes by, they want to talk. We don't have an agenda. We're not here for ourselves. We're here for you.
Almost all workplace chaplains are Christian. Eaton is a pastor at his own non-denominational church, but he only talks about religion when asked about it. Otherwise, he keeps it secular and social.
Y'all take it easy.
You too. Have a good week.
Yep.
The idea is not really a new one. It's just gaining a new resonance in corporate life.
David Miller, with Princeton University's Faith and Work Initiative, is writing a book about workplace chaplains. He says embedding missionaries goes back centuries, from English factories during the Industrial Revolution to the U.S. military. So what's brought clergy from the battlefield to the boardroom? A desire to make employees happy. If a chaplain can help keep anxiety down and workers on task, productivity goes up. Still, there are risks to mixing religion and work.
What signal are you sending to the employees? Is your business a house of worship or is it a house of work? With chaplains running around, some people might feel a little awkward.
Generally, a professional chaplain is not out proselytizing or trying to convince people to have a relationship with God. Chaplains really are less about talking and more about listening.
Ephraim Karp is a rabbi and president of Neshama, an association of Jewish chaplains. He says the industry is starting to adopt common standards and growing fast. That's certainly the case at Marketplace Ministries. When Gil Strickland started the nonprofit 30 years ago, he had trouble getting a single client. Now he has chaplains in 1,000 cities, and maps of his operations in China and South Korea hang on office walls.
We're there to take care of everybody, no matter if you're Buddhist or Baptist.
Strickland, who's 80 years old, was an Army chaplain for decades. He's worn patrol caps, hard hats, and cowboy hats to work sites. Chaplains, he says, are kind of like a pickup truck. You might not think you want one, but there comes a time when you'll need one. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Silverman in Dallas.
Hanukkah starts on Tuesday night, and for many Jewish families, especially those with children, part of that celebration is to munch on gelt, chocolate coins covered in gold and silver foil. Reporter Dina Pritchett unwraps the story of this sweet holiday tradition.
To be honest, Hanukkah gelt is not really known for being all that delicious.
It snaps. It's not soft and buttery. It's waxy. This is the chocolate that you have to chew.
Ariel Cohn runs Tree of Life, a Jewish preschool in Portland, Oregon.
Turn it.
The 2-year-olds here don't seem to share the same criticisms of Hanukkah gelt.
Whoa! Chocolate.
Yum!
Yum!
But even though the chocolate might not please adult palates, Cohn says she still has a soft spot for it because it's Hanukkah.
It's what human life is made of. Holidays and gatherings where you see your family and your friends, and you can make anything a part of tradition, really.
But it turns out this particular part of tradition used to look a lot different.
In the old world, in Jewish Eastern Europe, and we'll call it the shtetl, we do find something that is called Hanukkah gelt, but it has nothing to do with children and nothing to do with chocolate.
Gina Glassman teaches Judaic studies at Binghamton University. She says that in the 19th century, Hanukkah gelt was basically an end-of-the-year tip for itinerant workers.
a butcher for kosher meat and a teacher for Jewish studies. And you'd even have a guy employed to bang on people's doors to wake them up for prayers. Hanukkah was a time you paid these men a little bit extra.
If people gave gifts at all, it was generally a few months later for the holiday of Purim. But as families moved from the community-centered shtetl to towns and cities, that started to change.
By the end of the 19th century, you see mysteriously the custom switch from giving tips to these guys to giving a little gift to your children.
And when Jews began to emigrate, it changed even more.
As Christmas is magnified in the American setting, it becomes a national holiday. Hanukkah is greatly magnified.
Jonathan Sarna teaches American Jewish history at Brandeis University. He says that while Hanukkah takes on new importance, focusing on kids and gifts, it maintains echoes of the past.
We've morphed that gelt into chocolate coins as a kind of cultural memory.
Sarna acknowledges that the rise of chocolate gelt in the early to mid-20th century is a small part of Hanukkah. But adopting new traditions and connecting them to the past is part of the larger story of Americanization.
You were able to signal that wonderful sense of being part of the larger society and apart from it at one and the same time.
And just as with chocolate bunnies or chocolate Santas, a simple treat can be a passport to this history of belonging and ritual and nostalgia, no matter how the chocolate tastes. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep.
This is NPR News. Next Tuesday evening is a holiday in my house, Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights. It's one of those festivals that make for the old joke summing up Jewish holidays. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. In this case, they were the Syrian Greeks, who a couple of centuries before the time of Jesus took control of Judea and did their best to Hellenize the locals. The Maccabees rebelled, retook the temple in Jerusalem, and rededicated it. Hanukkah means dedication in Hebrew. And this year I read some interesting observations about Hanukkah in historian Simon Shammah's book, The Story of the Jews. And Simon Shammah joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
First, Hanukkah is 8 days long, and you write that it may have been structured to be an eight-day holiday by the heirs of the Maccabees.
Yes, that's right. The Hasmonean dynasty, who declared themselves rather scandalously in terms of tradition, simultaneously high priests and kings, which actually had been a no-no. They needed a major festival. This was a kind of politically instituted festival to rewrite a little bit the story by which they had come to power, and particularly to emphasize the endless hostility between being Jewish and being Greek, which in fact had not been the case for a long time. They chose 8 days for Hanukkah because it was the same number of days for the Feast of Tabernacles, for Sukkot, and they wanted it to be as important in the Jewish ritual calendar as Tabernacles. But the rabbis later on said, no, there's something fishily human about Hanukkah, and it's not mentioned in the Torah and the Bible, so it's going to be an unofficial holiday, which means we can all drive to the Lutkers.
The potato pancakes.
Well, the potato pancakes,
eight days or so.
This was not a feature of either Judean, Syrian, or Greek cooking, the latke, I'm afraid.
8 days is also the length of Passover, and so they were creating a holiday that was a twinned
story of great national liberation.
Yes, they may have had the Feast of Esther, actually, which is not that long, but is also a story of exactly a story. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. But you have to remember, really, that there hadn't been a Jewish kingdom for a long time before the Maccabean Revolt created some sort of independent Jewish state. It was then spectacularly successful. It started to conquer a lot of its neighbors and actually force Judaism on them. But the story which we all know about,
yes,
the miracle of the oil,
yes,
did this shock you, Robert, that it didn't happen?
The first time I learned this, it did shock me, but the official story was they came and they found enough oil in the temple to keep the eternal flame going for only one day, but it lasted miraculously for eight.
Yes, didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
Sorry, everybody. Well, this was an invention for centuries later by the rabbis who wrote the Mishnah and the Talmud. No luckers in that case, actually. Because
yes, the importance is that they're burned in oil. They're
indeed
cooked in oil. Yeah, that's
indeed
the only,
yes,
only significance, I guess. Yeah. The way that you write about it, the question facing Jews in the Greek civilization that dominated the Middle East after the time of Alexander the Great, the question wasn't so much, do we become Greek or Jews, but rather just being how Greek is being too Greek is really
exactly
the question.
Exactly. There were all sorts of ways in which it was not a problem any more than it's a problem being Jewish American. Everybody spoke Greek. Everybody dressed indistinguishably from other Greeks. I think actually what we're celebrating is, you know, the difficulties of pluralism, which could not be more resonant in the contemporary world. How do you stay faithful to one kind of religion while living as a part of a much broader religion, which may not agree, but without the obligation to exterminate each other? What happens in the Hanukkah story when it's rewritten is, you know, quite true account of this one particular demented king, Antiochus IV, who decides that this is impossible and the Jews are not allowed to eat kosher food and the temple must be desecrated and rededicated to Dionysos. What's striking is that when he's got rid of, when he's defeated, the Jews come back to a rather easygoing relationship with their language, their dress, their literature, and they become, again, perfectly happily Hellenized Jews.
Simon Schammer, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Happy Hanukkah, Robert.
Thank you.
Try not to overdo the luck.
I shall try. Simon Schammer's book that we've been talking about, by the way, where he writes about the story of the Jews through 1492, is called The Story of the Jews.